The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
New highs, and more new highs for the markets. Consumer confidence sags in the latest report. Market breadth is showing something of a concern, and our guest today is Kate Stalter, the founder of Better Money Decisions and the host of America Talks Money Financial Podcast. All this and much more on episode number 496 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me today. We're going to be talking about a variety of different things, of course, about your money, about investments, about the markets, about the economy, about the world, all things that hopefully are of interest to you and will help you in your daily, weekly, and your long-term investment process. Yeah, there was some new highs on the markets for the week, and that was good. We saw that there was a nice move to crude, which seemed to help the rally along, even though there was an enormous build. We saw that the first report on Tuesday evening showed somewhere around a 15 million barrel build of oil, which was far greater than anticipation. And we saw that on Wednesday morning at 10:30, with the quote unquote official number comes out in terms of inventories, another, I think it was 13.5 million barrel build was also put on. Now, there was some question as to, well, maybe there was something to the effect that there was a some oil that was taken out of the strategic reserves and put into the actual inventories, and that may have skewed the numbers a bit, and there was some other things. Anyway, what was interesting about this was whatever the reason for the actual build and maybe not being as concerning was we saw that the reaction to crude was quite opposite of what you would have thought. Crude actually ran up dramatically during the last couple of days of the week, and that obviously had an effect on markets as well as energy shares moved up really very nicely. But yeah, we have some new highs on the markets. This is all started when President Trump put out a tweet earlier in the week that said that within the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a fantastic tax deal on the table. And the whole idea, we've been talking about this so much, that the whole market movement of late is really predicated on the thought of a repatriation potentially, but more so on the idea that there's going to be a significant tax reduction on the corporate level. Regulations will be reduced, and all of that drops right down immediately. I mean, there's no question about how long it's going to take. Immediately down to the bottom line of companies. Now, whether or not it's going to be a plan that is exactly and as hopeful as many investors envision it to be, or if it's going to be something less, and then we'll have to deal with the letdown, remains to be seen. But what we are seeing right now is a tremendous amount of optimism that's going into that. So if you're wondering, like, what's going on with markets? Why are things, you know, why do we have this constant bid underneath markets? It's because if, in fact, there are taxes that will be reduced on a corporate basis of, let's say, from 35 or take your number down to 20, all of that is immediately impacting the bottom line and the margins for companies. Profitability will soar, and that's a good thing for companies. So immediately you'll see that once the taxes are actually put into play and they have to look at their guidance moving forward for whatever time period that the taxes are actually implemented, it is going to be very significant in terms of the benefit for companies. So that's something you just need to think about and consider. So one of the things that also we're seeing in the markets is, along with these new highs, is a shrinking of the breadth. So in other words, the new highs and new lows, the stocks that are actually participating in new highs, once again, we're starting to see something that we saw back in, I think it was 2015, where there was a significant amount of movement in markets, but what we were seeing was that the largest of companies, the mega caps, were the ones that were really doing a lot of the heavy lifting when it came to moving markets up. As we know, when you look at Apple and Facebook and you look at Exxon, you look at the companies like IBM, the big companies out there, and maybe not all these names, but you look at the big names out there, the high-priced stocks inside of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the largest capitalization stocks inside of the S&P 500 and NASDAQ. When those move, what they do is they have a disproportionately larger effect on the actual index themselves. So sure, yeah, we have seen just a dramatic move with small caps since Donald Trump was elected president and thinking there's going to be a lot lower regulation and tax benefits, et cetera. But also what we're seeing now is that the large caps have really taken over to move markets significantly. And that in itself is a very powerful move on a broad base. Now, we have, in addition to that, a lot of people and a lot of investors playing the ETFs like the SPY or the Qs. When the money goes into that, of course, it's disproportionately put into the largest capitalization stocks as well. And that is also helping to move markets. At the same time, when you look underneath what's happening, there is some weakness that is showing up with the stocks that aren't so important, with the names that are not the largest capitalization or the highest price when it comes to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So these things are sometimes called diverging technical indicators that you want to look at. What does it mean? What does it mean to us? What does it mean to you and me? Well, if we look back at 2015, we did see that when there was a situation like this, it didn't really end very well because, of course, towards the middle of the year and once things started rolling over, it rolled much harder. And we saw that in the beginning of 2016 in particular, towards the first month of 2016, when things started to get a little bit dicey in markets and started to see some selling that was picking up, well, the markets rolled over because now the participation wasn't there to begin with many of the names other than these larger cap and ones that had a much greater impact on the markets themselves because of the fact that they're large. So is that going to happen? I don't know. Right now, I can tell you something that did happen that I thought was very interesting. And I mentioned this before, but the Arrow strategy, this is our algorithmic strategy that we run here. And it basically does a few things. It does a massive calculation of a dozen or so different indicators that we have, either some traditional indicators or proprietary indicators that we created. And it puts them all together in a scoring process. And it looks at a lot of different things, but it looks at trend and it looks at overbought and oversold conditions for the S&P 500. This is money that we manage. Both a small portion of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy has an Arrow strategy as a diversifier, and it's a standalone as well. Now, one of the things that was interesting is that, as we know, you could either be long, you can be short, or you can be out. So long, short, or neutral are the three possible positions for the Arrow strategy. Now, what was really fascinating was about 2 days before the election, the Arrow was short. It covered the short for a profit. The signal came and we went long. Bought the S&P 500 through an ETF long. Okay. More information, by the way, on this and all the strategies is over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Definitely check those out. You know, if you're considering, hey, you know, what can I do to diversify my portfolio? What are the things that are off? Check out these, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy and also the Arrow Strategy. Plenty of information there, as well as we just put up a brand new performance characteristics, trading history, et cetera, for Arrow. So when you go over to the Disciplined Investor, you can grab that information right there. Just download the report. But just to get back to this, what I thought was really interesting was that on, I think it was Thursday, the Arrow strategy went from a long position that was held from a couple of days before the election to neutral, out of the market. Now, the Arrow itself is only out of the market about 8% of the time over the last 20 years. Not a lot of time, considering how it actually brings on and signals trades. What was really fascinating was that on Thursday, the signal came to exit the long position. I think it was about a 9.9% gain from the last time that it actually went long, again, a couple of days before the election. And it held through all of the different movement until just Thursday. It reached an overbought level that hasn't been seen since 2014. Now, sometimes I will share with you that overbought levels can continue for some time. Oversold levels are not as, I would say, as you don't see them holding as long because a lot of people look for these massively oversold levels to buy back in. But many people, even though things are getting very much overpriced or overbought, will continue to hold on to their positions. That's just the mentality of the investor. So we saw this, and right now we are in a neutral or cash position, which I don't know how long that's going to last. But it's very interesting to note that this has finally occurred. We saw this really significant level on the arrow algorithm, the calculation and score of the algorithm. And we got a double confirmation of where we started to see it to roll over a little bit. Again, it doesn't have to do with necessarily the action of the market itself, but there's a lot of sentiment indicators and oscillators and trenders in there. So the trend is still in an uptrend when it comes to the long-term nature of where we are seeing the arrow algorithm, just focusing on that. However, something is signaling an overbought situation. We'll have to see how this plays out, but I thought it was pretty interesting that that happened just last week. So for what it's worth, that's from the For What It's Worth Club, okay? You know, you can find out more about that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you haven't seen it, by the way, thedisciplinedinvestor.com has had a total revamp. You can do all sorts of searching now for a guest, how many times a stock was mentioned on the shows going back many, many years. If you want to find out all the times that DOS was on, you can do a search on the podcast summary page. Very cool stuff that's available right there. We're going to get to some listener questions next week, but I wanted to spend some time with Kate Stalter, who is our guest. I had her on in the past several times, but I wanted to ask her some core questions because we've had some people asking me recently about going back to basics again and some areas about, you know, long-term planning and financial planning, the concept of beyond just an investment idea or just what's happening in markets. Let's kind of step back and look at what's happening with me, my finances, and how can I actually properly prepare? So I thought I'd reach out to Kate, who actually has a great breadth of knowledge on this area. So we could talk with her about that and kind of get a little bit of a switch up here in what we usually talk about on the show. So how about we get to our guest? And our guest today is Kate Stalter, and she's a licensed investment advisor, representative, and founder of Better Money Decisions, which is a fee-only investment advisory firm and offices in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Scottsdale. That's the dry area where dry heat is okay, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Not a whole lot of humidity in any of these places we have our offices right now.
You know, it's funny because people are like, oh, you're in Florida. It's so hot. It's humid. And I'm like, oh, where are you? Oh, I'm in Scottsdale. It's dry heat. I'm like, I've been to Scottsdale when it's 100 degrees and you're walking, let's say, somewhere and a car passes you by and that breeze from that comes off it and it like scorches your face.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I was out there yesterday, as a matter of fact, as we're speaking, and it was pretty pleasant. It was in the 70s. And it's the kind of weather that you're like, oh, if it's always like this, that would be great, but it's not. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a lot of things. I mean, I don't know when the last time we had you on, but I know you're doing a little bit of a different thing. You have a podcast that's called, what is your podcast called?
It's called America Talks Money. Andrew, we'll have to circle back and have you as a guest on the show. That's something I wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
And we just launched.
And I know you have, a lot of things that you write about, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things I wanted to really focus in on here, because I think you have a unique perspective when it comes to some of this from the times that we've talked, et cetera. Let's just talk about a couple of things at random. And I want to get into the discussion of this idea of longevity. I want to talk about some behavioral finance, but there's this whole idea of an investment philosophy versus trading and speculating and you know, different things for different people, right? So talk to me a little bit about what a core, and I look at it as a core, right? You know, your core investment philosophy is, as opposed to trading and speculating.
Yeah, and it's really, it's interesting because I think maybe even the term investment philosophy, and I use that term, I wonder if it kind of sounds a little more highfalutin than it really is. You know, it's really just the idea of when you're investing your money, looking at what the purpose is. And for most people, for our clients anyway, it's to finance retirement. Now, I know at different parts of people's lives, it might be for, say, saving in a 529 plan for their kids' education. You know, there's other goals like maybe saving for a house, but let's just call it retirement because that's what most of our clients are. And the investment philosophy comes into play when you're deciding how much, what does the money need to do for me? How much do I need? You know, it's really, we teach Social Security seminars. And one of the things we say to people, Andrew, is that the wrong question to ask about Social Security is when can I get the money? The right question to ask is how much income do I need? So I think for all retirees, that's the thing to look at. How much income do I need? You know, from all these sources, whether it's Social Security, whether it is a pension, whether you have investments, whether you have your 401k, whether there's something that you've just inherited. And that's where the philosophy comes into play, is you have to ask yourself, okay, how do I need to invest this money in order to generate enough income with the right level of risk to sustain my lifestyle till the time I'm 100. I know we can talk a little bit about life expectancy in North America today, but we count on the fact that, you know, plan to live to 100. And I don't care what age your parents live to. I want to say that to everybody right now. That's kind of irrelevant. And that's kind of how people judge longevity. But when you come back to how to invest, that's your philosophy. What do I need to do to generate the income? And speculating, saying, okay, I'm going to go all in on Apple or GE or Facebook or, you know, the VIX or gold, whatever it is, that is speculating on one asset class. And if you want to have a little side account where you trade some stocks and you gamble, you know, that's absolutely fine. We have a client who recently has just begun to invest a little bit in some of the marijuana stocks, which are penny stocks. Now, he knows, he's well aware that's his play money account. That is not something where you're saying, okay, well, what kind of return can you get from these marijuana stocks to sustain your retirement? No, no, no. And the issue, by the way, I want to clarify, it's not because it's marijuana stocks that I'm
right,
saying
right, no,
you don't
I get
want
it.
To speculate. Right.
I get it, yeah.
It could be, you know, the Dow Jones, if you're just betting on the big Dow stocks and speculating. So that's really what the crux of the investment philosophy is what kind of risk and return scenario does each person need?
And what's interesting about this, I think, is that the idea that so many people are out there listening, looking, and when to a TV show, news item, podcast, a newsletter about the one big hit or the multiple big hits. Like what stock tip can I get from this today? And that's great. But when you really think about this, I think what you're saying is, and I agree with this, by the way, there's something about what we call a core portfolio allocations, right? So you have a core portfolio that you look at for long-term returns for, you know, and looking for and make sure that whether it's your retirement plan or whether it's, you know, in terms of a IRA or a 401k or whatever it may be. And then there's also the other side, which is, like you mentioned, the speculative side. Now, speculation comes in a lot of different methods. I mean, you want to deal with futures or options, whatever, fine. But there's something to be said about having a diversification, which is probably key to all of this, in a core portfolio, and then diversifying further by having another portfolio or another way of investing that may be more speculative, that may be tied together somehow in the long picture, but not overweighting one or the other. And I guess that talks about diversification. And one of the things that has for years always made my just make me ponder is the whole idea that many people think that, well, investing only in the US is a safer bet than investing internationally, whether it's emerging markets, developed markets, etc. Why are people so concerned and look at foreign markets and you want to look at developed markets, for example, much differently than we look at U.S. markets? Is it just because we're here and they're there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's one of it. I think that's one reason is because, you know, if you turn on the TV and say you happen to watch, oh, call it CNBC all day long. Oh. And yeah, don't do that, by the way. But if you do, all you see all day long is a parade of people talking about the U.S. markets. All day long, this breathless coverage of what the NASDAQ is doing, what the S&P 500 is doing, and, you know, God forbid, the 30-stock Dow is doing. So what I think is easy to overlook and forget is, oh, my gosh, U.S. stocks make up about half, little more than half right now, because U.S. markets have done really well in the last few years. But right now, U.S. stocks represent about 52% of the total world market capitalization. And yes, it's what we hear about. You know, when I drive down the street here, what am I passing? Starbucks, McDonald's, Sherwin-Williams, Chipotle, Kohl's. I mean, all these publicly traded companies, just when we leave our house and drive down the street, that's what we see. So we're kind of, remember those old, those very old commercials when I was a little kid, it was about the Palmolive. You're soaking in it. Yeah. Well, yeah, we're soaking in these big U.S.
Madge.
Stocks.
That was Madge.
You're right. That was Madge. Yeah. 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 We're soaking in it. So, you know, you don't really, we don't know about all these little small cap European stocks. So that's one thing. The other thing, too, is that the international markets have not done as well as the U.S. markets. Now, emerging markets kind of had a bit of a rally in the last few months. But overall, while the U.S. markets have done really well in the past 7 or 8 years, international stocks have not. Now, there's a graphic, Andrew, that I show to clients, and it's pretty interesting. It shows the different asset classes in that time period between 2000 and 2009. So think about that, like how, and that's a decade that investors just kind of say, oh, I want to forget all about that particular decade. Americans, for American stocks, it was a lost decade. The S&P 500 had a negative return of 9.1% between 2000 and 2009. Okay. Meanwhile, other asset classes did much better. So you had even small cap U.S. stocks, not the common household names, not the Dow, not the S&P, but not even the NASDAQ 100. You had small cap U.S. stocks did very well during that decade. International stocks did great. Emerging markets were through the roof during that decade. Even bonds did better. So, you know, Jim Cramer wrote a book after the whole 2008 debacle called Getting Back to Even. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, for investors who held a diversified portfolio, getting back to even happened much, much quicker and then some. And then when U.S. stocks began to rally in 2009, that only added to it. So in other words, the global diversification does help. But the problem is, in recent memory, U.S. stocks have done much, much better. And there was so much scary news out of Europe for several years in there, and people just kind of shied away. And the problem is, you never, if there were a way to accurately predict, you know, all this stock picking stuff, and you know that I come from that world, that was sort of how I got my feet wet in financial services, mm-hmm. was in more of the stock picking world. If there were a foolproof way, it would work all the time and everybody would be doing it all the time and there'd be no TV networks because it would be so flipping boring. But it's not that way.
Well, it's getting there. It's getting closer. Yeah. it is getting closer. I mean, you look at all the algos and you look at how you have all the social media, you have all the, you know, mm-hmm. it's different today. I don't know how mm-hmm. far back you actually go with all this, but I remember the time back when you worked for Investors Business Daily, probably mm-hmm. before you worked with Investors Business Daily, that I used to go to the, way back. This is going way back. The only way was to get my information and do research was maybe go to the library on the weekends or, right. you know, or, mm-hmm. or buy it. God forbid you buy a paper. But you go to the library, you grab the Investor Business Daily, you grab the Barron's, you grab the Wall Street Journal, you mm-hmm. grab a bunch of the other S&P books, the actual the stock books, right? And mm-hmm. you did some research that way and you did some charting, et cetera. It wasn't as accessible as it is today. And as we get more and more technology and the ability for AI, I mean, AI is going to be something here. Every single time you see a Trump tweet, for example, something happens. Uh-huh. Now, It could be good. It could be bad. It could be at the end of the day, it may have been a wash. But the point is that these things happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. So do you think that there is a change in investment philosophy amongst the younger people that have this as their baseline of, well, this is how it's done? They don't remember any of the other stuff. They don't remember research in the way that we remember research. You know, they don't remember actually reading the sell side and buy side analysis like mm-hmm. we do from back then, mm-hmm. and trying to understand that and really understanding the information from the, listen, how many companies miss earnings and guide down and you see a stock like, why did it go up today? For right. example, you know, what is mm-hmm. what is I'm missing? You know, who knows what's happening? So I guess the question I'm asking you is there a change in the investment, not the philosophy, but in the investment identification of what investments are, what they can do with the younger people, let's say under 40, mm-hmm. Compared to what's over 40 and what they know? Is things happening much differently now?
You know, you can look back. Again, I haven't done this, but I guess you could look back and say, is there more volatility today than there ever was? And this question, I haven't done that since I worked at IBD. And we did at some point. I remember that was a question that somebody asked Bill O'Neill at one point. Is there more volatility today? The answer actually turned out to be no. Now, that was about 2010 because I left IBD in 2010. So it was sometime before then.
And by the way, I would agree with that in concept, in mm-hmm. that the more readily available information is, the less gaps you have mm-hmm. in the understanding of the markets and what is reality. So there's a much tighter level of understanding, and therefore there won't be the volatility. So if all information is available is out, which mm-hmm. goes to the whole thing of, oh, the stock markets are usually 6 months into the future, right? People would look at that and look at the news and then say, okay, what's the reality of what's happening? And then in the past, if you could only look these things up every once a week or so, uh-huh. there's a gap. So therefore, there's a lot more surprises.
Let me just cut to the chase here, I think, is that if you're gambling your retirement or your whatever goal, if you're a 30-year-old, whatever goals you have, I mean, maybe you're saving for retirement, maybe you're saving for your child's 529, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of young people that have many assets, to be quite honest with you, Andrew. Mm-hmm. I really haven't.
Right.
So it in a way, it's a theoretical question. But if you're a young person and you're thinking, I want to gamble because I don't know, you know, Facebook may run higher today because of something Trump tweets, or Boeing may go lower because of something Trump tweets. Let me gamble on this. Why would you do that?
Right. You know? The only people that should be doing that is if obviously you're a dedicated day trader.
Right.
That can move fast enough in and out of something to do, or I'll even go further, a dedicated scalp trader.
Yeah.
Which is even faster, you know? Let's move on for something, because I want to ask you a couple of other important questions here. You mentioned the whole idea, we're talking about young people and older people and the whole idea of longevity. And you mentioned something, you said, you know, plan to live to 100. Now it's interesting because I got in the business 1987, six or seven. What was that for? Like, can't believe I'm still around.
Were you 12? Were you 12 when you got into the business?
Actually, I got into the business in my early 20s. But back then the planning was something like this. Okay, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, we're going to work on, you know, your long-term plan here. And here's what we're going to lay out for you. You're 45 years old. You're going to retire. This is pretty much how it was. You're going to retire at 65. You'll live 10 years and that's it. Mm-hmm. That was the plan. I mean, and truly that was the plan. And people would pretty much take whatever. That was easy enough. I just got to save enough to last 10 years.
Right. Quite different.
Quite different. So, and the amount of savings that you would need at that point, and for whatever reason, this, and by the way, this was for a long time how things played out. Not necessarily recently, but way back, people would work and pretty much just die right afterwards if they stopped working. Right. So now, these days, the planning is much different, right? So if I was to sit down right now, exactly the same people and talk with them, you'd have to say something like, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, you're 45 years old. You're probably going to work till about 70 or so. That's what people, you know, are doing. And, you know, you may have another 15, 20 years, you know, maybe 100, like you're saying, but 15 or 20 years that we're going to have to plan for. So now all of a sudden we went from age 75, which was the time when they were going to stop needing income on average, to something like 90. We know we're talking about a 15-year period. So now you have to fund your retirement a much longer time. So what are people doing?
It's so much more difficult. And, you know, I mean, that's exactly right, what you just said. We teach Social Security seminars, and there's a little slide in there, and it's fascinating to me because it shows the average life expectancy in the United States in the 1930s when Social Security was started, and it was 65.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that took into account people who died as children. I mean, you have to keep that in mind, that the average life expectancy, if you look at it that way, it takes into account everybody, which kind of brings it down a little bit. It's obviously grown over the years, and I believe the average life expectancy as of about 2010, it's probably higher now, was about 78. Now, you have to keep in mind, though, for people who live to 65, it's kind of interesting because to a point, the longer you live, then the longer you're going to live because you get through certain risky stages of your life. You know, you get through that stage when you're more likely to die in a car accident, say, when you're younger. By the time you get to 65, it's kind of like you've made it through certain other things, and then you're likely to live till your mid-80s on average. And the other piece of this, Andrew, is that the number of people living to 100 grew by, this is astonishing, by 43% over the last decade. Right? Now, it's still a relatively small number of Americans, but it's growing. And here's the other thing. 80% of those people living to 100 are women. So you see where this becomes a very specific issue. So you're absolutely right. The planning thing, I'll tell you what bugs me is when I hear people say, I'm going to work forever. It's like, no, you won't. No, you won't.
There's a time period that you're going to be thrown out. Or you're not going to be able to do your job. Or, I mean, listen, my father-in-law, he's 83. And I had to take away his car recently. And I didn't want to do it because why? He's like, what are you doing? I said, listen, you can barely walk. I mean, you know, he walks fine, but he's kind of like wobbles.
That's and I'm tough,
like,
yeah.
And your reaction time is not as great as it was. And I'm really concerned about that. So he's all mad at me about that.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, he's better. He gets it now. Thank God for Uber.
Yeah.
Or as he calls it, Uber. So now, but there's a big issue here because the fact is that I think people have a sense of what they're trying to accomplish, and it takes sometimes a lot more. And we're also in a world that people like to spend now and enjoy now more. You know, then the old days, people would put away everything, they'd suffer, you know, like they'd suffer. They'd put away as much as they can, put away, which by the way, ended up being much better for the future generations because it was inheritances. These days, people say, you know, I want to be able to spend my last dime on my deathbed.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
So that, I want to time it just right. And I'm like, well, okay, fine. But I don't know how that's going to work, but okay, we'll try to plan that. But is this issue, we could talk all day about how it's going to affect Social Security, by the way, if the original plans were to have someone living to 75 and they live a lot longer and it's guaranteed for their life. But that's another discussion. So when you're dealing with planning, what should people do and think about in terms of their longevity to accurately plan? I mean, what are some of the main things that they really need to focus on?
You know, the issue, I think, couple things. First of all, I'll give you an example of kind of a sad situation. And I think the takeaway from this story is going to be, think about this before you become these people. A couple years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, somebody reached out to me. She was in her mid-70s. She was a realtor. Her husband was about 88. And they were retired. They had not saved anything. Her husband had, he had a decent job. He had been a scientist, actually. And he had a pension. And they both had Social Security. They owned their home outright. But it really wasn't a whole lot. They were kind of scraping by a little bit. And at that point, it sort of became, well, your only option here to raise any more cash. Now, she was still working as a realtor in her mid-70s. And that kind of comes back to what we were just talking about. Isn't it? How long can you really do that? And their only option maybe to raise a little more cash might have been to sell that house and downsize into something cheaper. But they had kind of painted themselves into a very sad corner because they waited too long. If I had talked to them 20 years sooner, maybe when she was in her 50s and he was in his 60s, yeah, you have some time there to kind of figure out, okay, how much longer should I work? How much more should I save? And that's sort of cold comfort to people that are a little older and haven't saved. But unfortunately, we're seeing that more and more. And that's why I am so heartened when we are getting more and more clients in their 50s. And what's funny, Andrew, is they come in and I tell them, I'm like, hey, you have time on your side. This is so good that you're doing this now. And they all kind of look at me like, you're kidding. I'm like, no, really. And that's something very important to remember. There's no tips. There's no tricks. It's just keep saving. And that's the message. People have not saved enough. And that's not a glamorous or sexy message, but that's really it.
But we do know something. We know for a fact, and it doesn't take anything but very simple math. The earlier you save, the better off. My daughter started working at a place, and she's got a 401k. So you got to start putting the money away. She goes, Dad, they don't match. I'm not putting money in if they don't give me anything. I'm like, wait a minute. Wait a second. This is money that you put in. You get a tax deduction for it through, or a bit of a tax relief from it because it comes out pre-tax. And so what? They don't give you any money. They'll give you money eventually. She has to qualify for a year. And no, I'm not doing it. I said, you are doing it. And then, fast forward about a year and a half, and she has whatever she has, like $10,000 saved in the account. She says, oh my gosh, that wasn't so hard.
Right.
And I said, no kidding. So she's 25, 26 years old right now. Let's say she stopped, just doesn't put another dime in there. And let's just say she earns 6% per year on something, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. The amount of money that she will amass over her lifetime when she wakes up one day and she's 50 years old, she'll be like, wow, that wasn't so hard. And the amount of compounding of interest is obviously a lot better. We all know that. So the earlier you start, the better. Let's shift over though. We don't have that much time. I want to talk about behavioral finance. We start with the whole idea of people thinking about, well, I believe this to be true. This is my general bias and this is going to happen. And I think the best example of this is very recently, we could all look at this is Trump is going to come into office. The market is going to collapse because all the different reasons why. Right. So we saw that the market did collapse as soon as he was elected, and that lasted a good 30 minutes.
Right.
maybe.
Yeah.
And then he comes out with, hey, we're going to reduce taxes, we're going to do this and all that. And a lot of people still are, hey, wait, when's this whole thing going to, blow out? But let's talk about, you wrote an article, I believe it was for USA Today, I believe it was.
US News.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you talk about behavioral biases that may hurt investing. So let's talk about the whole idea of loss aversion, which is a real thing, by the way. That's not necessarily, there is a little bit something about people don't want to lose money. But how does that hurt investing?
Yeah. It's funny because people tend to notice, for example, when an investor is kind of, things are just trucking along. I mean, you were just talking about the example of your daughter. That's a good one because I think it's true for all of us. When things are just going along, you don't really pay attention. You're like, yeah, markets are going up. It's fine. And then maybe you turn on the news one day and they're going nuts because maybe the Dow is down 1% or something and there's breathless coverage and it's breaking news. And, those are the days that people say, wow, wait a second. How much am I losing today because of this? And then the next day it all bounces right back and everybody forgets about it and their performance is good for the quarter. But they zero in on those days. Now, if you have good quarterly performance, you do kind of forget about it. But everybody remembers 2008. Everybody remembers that. That is still fresh on people's minds, I understand, because it was pretty traumatic. And that's what people remember in terms of, oh my gosh, investing is so dangerous. I can't do it. Andrew, when I tell people that the S&P 500 has tripled in value since 2009, they don't believe me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they don't believe me because all we hear is bad news, doom and gloom, how horrible everything is. And that's what people key in on. It's like people think that their portfolios have lost money. And it's like, no, you've actually gained.
Right. I have a client who every single time we do something in their portfolio, he's been with me for 15 years. Mm-hmm. He's a pretty significant portfolio, but he's an elderly gentleman in his 90s. And every time we do something, like, for example, we rotate the portfolio, just a small item, and we say, you know, we're going to pull some money out of XYZ investment and we're going to put it in cash or we're going to invest it here. And invariably when we talk about it, he says, how much did I lose on it? I said, what do you mean?
Right.
You didn't lose money. You didn't lose any money on it. You made money on it.
Right.
Okay. But every time, I mean, honestly, for years now, how much did I lose on it? I'm like, no, you didn't lose. I mean, you'd think that after a while he would get into the mode of this, you know, that maybe it isn't a loss. Just let's start out with, okay, did I make or lose money on it? Ask me that question, not how much did I lose on it. But, right. You know, but it's interesting because people can be trained. Most people, not all. and you know what? The behavioral finance idea has been coming into vogue significantly. We know that people can be trained because we know that the Fed has well-trained investors. As you mentioned earlier, it popped right back up the next day, you said.
Yep.
But the Fed has trained investors, you know, to look at, well, if the worst case of worst, if markets drop and the economy slows down, which we haven't seen even a hair of a market movement to the downside. And I can't remember when. I mean, a little bit here and there, 3%, 2%, right. Whatever. But really, and then what happens? It comes back the next day. And once it turns, yep. It turns hard.
Yep.
So this is not a normal, quote unquote, normal long-term market situation that we've been seeing for some time here, right? And do you think that people are now trained differently to be in their behavior of, okay, well, it's down. Well, that's good news now. Mm-hmm. It's down. I'm going to buy.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's hard for people to do. I know what you're saying. I totally agree with you that sort of the speed at which the news comes at you. And you're absolutely right. It's like you turn on your computer, and even if you don't follow the markets, you do see a stock report on there, and it's all over Twitter and Facebook. So it's kind of all in everybody's face right now. But I think it's still really hard for people to train themselves to think, well, things are low. Now's the time to buy, you know, buy low. I think as things are falling, people are more inclined to, oh my gosh, panic, bail out.
Right.
I still think that's more the mentality right now.
I think there's a little bit of a panic to get in right now at the moment, at the moment. People are just saying, oh, you know what? Every single little dip. Listen, every single dip you could watch throughout the day, every time there's a little bit of a drop, it's picked right back up. The bigger the drop, the bigger the pickup. You know, and this is all because of the anticipation of a lot of things. But let's talk about also, this is something that I don't think we've covered on the show before, but it's definitely something that I think is out there that I want to ask you about. Confirmation bias. Explain that.
Yeah. So what that happens when you look for evidence that kind of validates what you already believe. So the one I love is the political TV channels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right now you've got Fox, you've got MSNBC. Well, you know, the people who believe one way tend to watch Fox. The people who believe another way tend to watch MSNBC. And guess what? All day long, that channel is going to confirm what you already believe. There's going to be very, very little, generally speaking, that's going to challenge your belief too much. You kind of know that's your safe space for confirming your political belief. And that's the same thing in the markets. I mean, I think, you know, this idea of, for example, you're the client you were speaking about, who's like, what did I lose? Well, he can easily turn on the TV and he can find evidence. Oh, there you go. There's some stocks that are down, right? So it's that. It's looking for things that you already believe. I mean, another example is I recently, last summer, I bought a Subaru Forester.
Mm.
And now I see them everywhere.
Oh,
they're everywhere.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's kind of like, oh, okay. Well, that confirms, I don't know what, that everybody likes these. It's just kind of this idea of seeking out things that validate your existing belief. And it's very easy to do.
Mm. What about the illusion of control bias?
Oh boy. Okay. You know, we kind of ventured into that a little bit today. And when it comes to investing, kind of where that comes into play is thinking, well, if I shuffle around my portfolio holdings, I can control my return. And, you know, there's that study from Dalbar every year or every couple of years that shows how the average investor does not even keep pace with the S&P 500. If you bought a simple S&P index fund, in many cases, you would have done better than the average investor who's trading and trying to time the market because they think, oh my gosh, if I make a trade here, I can control what happens in my portfolio. I got to tell you something. My dad is really bad about this. He likes, when he sees the news, he's like, okay, we got to do something. I'm like, okay, what? something. I don't know, like sell, buy. So it's that kind of thing about the control. I think the example I used in the U.S. News article was, and this is a good one, anytime you see like a plane crash in the news, mm-hmm. how many people get on social media and they're like, well, that's why I prefer to drive.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, statistically, driving is more dangerous,
yeah.
you know?
Right.
So it's that kind of
idea. And then you get into the confirmation bias right after that.
Yeah, right,
of course,
right.
You know, and then that deals with loss aversion as well, by the way. All of this is the same thing in life and in investing. So
right.
we'll put all of the information about how to get in touch with Kate on the show notes for this episode. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Why don't you give them your website? We'll put it on the site too, but just you could say it so we can people that are listening can get there.
Yeah, let me give you two of them. There's the podcast is AmericaTalksMoney.com and the registered investment advisor is BetterMoneyDecisions.com.
Better Money Decisions. We'll put both mm-hmm. of them on there and I'm going to write down podcast here. We will make sure that people get in touch with you. I want to thank you as always as being our guest. We'll have you on soon.
Oh, absolutely. This is always fun, Andrew. All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good day. Bye-bye. That was pretty interesting. I thought that was actually awesome. You know, we look at behavioral finance and there's so much written about this whole area of behavioral finance. And like I mentioned with our guest, Kate, there's several that she's written about. Loss aversion, confirmation bias, mental accounting, illusion of control bias, recency bias, hindsight bias, and herd mentality, which I think is a lot of what's going on right now in markets. We have this herd mentality that everybody's like, I got to buy in because we're not sure why, but everybody's buying in. It's also called momentum investing. It's another way to look at things. So we'll again, put all the information on how to get the articles that she wrote, as well as in touch with Kate on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Next week, and over the next few weeks, we are going to be planning for our 500th episode. If anybody would like to maybe comment or say a few things, if they've been maybe long-term listeners to the show, well, you can go over to Ask Andrew. That's one way. We're actually going to put a phone number up, I think, too, where you can actually record something for the show if you're inclined to do so. And but if you want to go over to Ask Andrew on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and write something, well, that's one way you can do it. And the other way that you can do it, if you want, just leave a message. We'll take the recording from that and put it on the show for those that have some comments to say about maybe how long you've listened, what you've learned. Give me some insight. You know, don't make it a 5-minute discussion. Just a quick little discussion for the 500th episode, which is a pretty major milestone, doing this for the last, I don't know, 8 years or so, 9 years almost. And if you've been listening for a while, if you have some comments to make, if you want to tell me about and tell the audience and maybe explain some of the things that you've learned, some of the things that you've gotten out of the show, some of the things that you want to just say, here's the phone number. You could just leave a message on it. It's 954-762-7533. And you could do this through the end of February, and then we'll take many of those and put them on the show. Well, that'd be kind of fun to do. Phone number 954-762-7533. That's only going to be through the end of February 2017. After that, that number is no good anymore. So don't use it for anything. It's just not going to be available for this. But just call up, leave a message, 954-762-7533. And we'll get that going for the 500th show. If you have some things, if you have some talent out there, you want to make a piece of artwork for it, maybe for the show, for the cover page, or maybe, you know, even some kind of other, who knows, be creative about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll put some of the best of on there as well from over the last number of years, the best guests, some of the things that we've heard from way back when. We'll bring back some things that we haven't heard for years on that show as well. All right, that's going to be a wrap for me today and for this week. I want to thank you for joining me. I'll see you again real soon.
The The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.